Fort Lauderdale tries once again to solve its homeless problem. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The city's past efforts usually ended with negative national attention. The city's once again closed a homeless encampment, this one downtown, but they didn't bring in the police or bulldozers. Government officials are working collaboratively with the community to find housing and get much-needed services to this vulnerable part of the population. Also, it's Hanukkah, and that means celebration for thousands in South Florida. But anti-Semitism is on the rise, and security is already building up at local synagogues. We'll talk with a Boca Raton rabbi about how the Jewish community is coming together during the holidays. Finally, Miami Art Week and Art Basel are upon us. We'll meet a couple of artists exposing local work to everyone, not just the art collectors. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Mourners are paying their final respects this hour to the nation's 41st president, George H.W. Bush, who died last week at the age of 94. He lies in state at the Capitol. His service dog, Sully, visited Bush's casket today. NPR's Windsor Johnson says many mourners are lined up outside the Capitol hoping to pay their final respects.
Wreaths of red roses surround Bush's casket as military members stand guard inside the Capitol rotunda. Mourners who've come from all over the country are filing by silently to pay their final respects. Ellen Tyler from Texas is among them.
I think he, just his temperament, you know, his, I think he cared about other people. I think he was sincere. I think he put politics aside sometimes. I thought he was a good guy.
Bush's body will be escorted to Washington National Cathedral for a state funeral on Wednesday. He'll be buried on Thursday in Texas. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, the Capitol.
The campaign arm of Republicans in the U.S. House confirms it is the victim of a cyber attack. A representative of the National Republican Campaign Committee says in a statement that the NRCC still does not know who was behind the hack. Both the committee and the FBI are conducting investigations. The U.S. military presence in Afghanistan is entering its 18th year, and NPR's Tom Bowman says the top officer slated to command all U.S. forces in the Middle East region says the war in Afghanistan is still a stalemate.
Lieutenant General Frank McKenzie told senators at his confirmation hearing that he served in Afghanistan, and his son has as well. But he cautioned that the war is still at a stalemate, and not just for U.S. forces and their Afghan counterparts, but for the Taliban as well.
Even as we are in a stalemate, so they are in a stalemate, and they will be unable to find a path to victory on the battlefield.
McKenzie said what's new in the equation is President Trump's envoy Zalmay Khalilzad, who for the first time is talking directly to the Taliban in hopes of a political solution. Meanwhile, both sides have increased military pressure. The U.S. killed a Taliban commander in southwest Helmand province. The Taliban killed four American soldiers in the east. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says the Chinese government is committing to buying an additional $1.2 trillion in U.S. exports in the coming years. Provided Beijing follows through, Mnuchin says that should be enough to close the U.S.'s massive trade deficit with China. President Trump has held out the possibility of an extension of the 90-day trade truce with China, but he warned if the countries cannot reach an agreement on trade that he is a tariff man. Well, U.S. markets are shaken. All major market indices are down 2.2%. to 2.6%. From Washington, this is NPR News. Delegates of oil-producing nations reportedly plan to hold a gathering in Vienna on Thursday. The Associated Press reports that analysts are projecting the group will agree on a cut of at least a million barrels a day in a bid to boost prices. Again, that's just a prediction. Crude prices began declining in October, in part due to fears that weaker global economic growth would hinder demand for energy. In midday trading today, West Texas Intermediate was holding steady at $52.95 a barrel. Brent International Crude was up an additional 35 cents to $62.04 a barrel in London. Runoff elections are taking place this day in Georgia. Two statewide offices are on the ballot. For member station WABE in Atlanta, Johnny Kaufman has the latest.
The biggest contest on the ballot is for Secretary of State, Georgia's top election official. It's getting special attention because of the recent governor's race here. The winner of that election in November, Republican Brian Kemp, remained Secretary of State throughout the race despite calls for him to step down. Kemp's opponent, Democrat Stacey Abrams, and civil rights groups filed multiple lawsuits over how the election was carried out. Most are still pending. On the ballot, running to be Georgia's next Secretary of State are Republican State Representative Brad Raffensperger and former Democratic Congressman John Barrow. Neither got enough votes to win outright in November. President Trump endorsed Raffensperger last week on Twitter. Abrams has endorsed Barrow. For NPR News, I'm Johnny Kaufman in Atlanta.
The Dow is down 553 points, 2.1% at 25,272. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform with over 18 million monthly users, designed to connect people from anywhere in the world on any device. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
Be a fan. Be a friend. Be a nerd. If you love WLRN, then own it. Show your support publicly with one of our cool WLRN items and be a part of the family. Go to shop.wlrn.org and get your goods.
We're funded by WLRN members and by LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform with over 18 million monthly users, designed to connect people from anywhere in the world on any device. More at GoToMeeting.com.
Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Cities across the country all try, and many struggle, to try to deal with the homeless population, try to help them, try to get them off the streets. Fort Lauderdale knows a thing or two about this. The city has made national news for its clashes with people like Arnold Abbott, the homeless advocate who continued to feed the homeless even when the city kept asking him to move his operations. Then earlier this year, bulldozers showed up to Stranahan Park, and they removed the belongings of dozens of people who were living in an encampment. Once again, Fort Lauderdale is trying to tackle this issue, but they're trying something else now. More than six dozen people living in an encampment in the middle of downtown are now moved out. But this time, the city is providing housing, helping with job searches, as well as offering mental health and substance abuse opportunities. Well, just last night, there was a contentious city commission meeting over a proposed housing unit in Fort Lauderdale that would hold hundreds of micro-unit apartments that could help some of these folks. They are intended for low-income residents, and the development is sponsored by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. We're joined now by Vice Mayor Ben Sorensen to talk about these issues. Vice Mayor Sorensen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Honored to be here.
Let's start with this. I mean, we talked to you earlier this year. You were actually working at the encampment. You set up a small table out there, and you shared some of the stories of the people that were living there. Just briefly remind us of what that experience was like for you.
Sure. So the homeless and the plight of the homeless is something that's been a long time concern of mine, and something I've worked on in the community for years. And I started off focusing on veterans. I'm a Navy veteran myself, and so formed a foundation through the organization through the United Way of Broward County here to help veterans. And how that worked was just a collaborative effort and of various stakeholders, government, nonprofit, business, all working together. So when I was elected a city commissioner here in Fort Lauderdale in March of this year, the broader homeless population was the next step that I saw in addressing our homeless issue, the non-veteran population. And not knowing exactly what would be the best solution set for them, I moved my office from City Hall down to this encampment where, as you described, there were about 60 or 70 tents and folks living there. It's an incredible opportunity, one, for me to be able to understand what these folks are facing, what their challenges, what their concerns are. Secondly, bring awareness to this from everyone that would meet with me. So whether it was someone talking about the potholes in their street, or someone talking about police in the city. Everyone got a chance to see what was happening. And then the final piece that really helped me is forming really great friendships with the folks that were living in this encampment to understand. And I would ask them, what's going to help you get on your feet? What services would you be interested in receiving, and how can we help you? And that helped me understand the solution set that we would then need to implement.
All right. Now, so you talked to all of these folks who were in this encampment, and real quickly, I mean, because we're talking about over 70 people at least, what's happened to that encampment? All of those folks now are gone, right?
Correct. So this led to a incredible united effort led by our United Way of Broward County, along with the Greater Fort Lauderdale Alliance and business leaders like Otto and the city of Fort Lauderdale and Broward County and law enforcement, all collectively working together to raise money. So one, we through city contribution, county contribution, AutoNation, other businesses, we raised about $4.4 million to provide for housing for all of these individuals and wraparound case management for these individuals. And so these folks are currently housed and on the path to housing, as well as the job support, mental health treatment, all those things in addition.
Real quickly, what can you tell us about this housing? Where have we put them up?
So it's been in various spots around the county, and one of the real positive initiatives under this umbrella is something called a landlord program, a housing first program within this umbrella. And what that was us as community members reaching out to landlords, property owners around the county and saying, hey, Mrs. Landlord, would you be willing to provide one apartment for a homeless person? We'll provide case management for that person. We'll provide rental. We'll pay rent for this individual, and we'll provide a risk pool, which is to say, if any damages beyond the security deposit happen, we will cover those costs. And so we have landlords around the county where these folks are now living.
And is this temporary housing? Is this more permanent? How does that work out?
We view this as permanent housing. They're signing year-long leases, and with continued efforts to raise, you know, resources and funding, we view this as a long-term solution. And we view a lot of these folks that have not had jobs now being able to get jobs. And just a quick anecdote was several of my friends down in the encampment were wanting jobs, were able to work 5 to 10 hours, but they could only work when someone would watch their possessions at
right.
the encampment, right? So now this has the opportunity to really increase employment.
So coming back, though, to the housing, so is it that the city, the county, I mean, the money that you've raised basically for this, is it to put them in for that year and then help them get a job so they can then begin to, you know, build their own lives?
Correct.
How long is the city willing to pay for them is what I'm saying.
So the city committed, so we committed about $1.2 million. The county committed about $1.2 million. Then businesses in addition and beyond that. And so as a city, we committed to 1 year, but we're very interested as long as this is working, as long as we're seeing the case management work and folks, you know, put forth the effort, we're very interested in continuing our support.
And then the other part of this is that you're offering mental health services, substance abuse services. Again, none of this is mandatory, or, I mean, how are you getting people to get the help they need? Because as you know, sometimes that's a struggle.
Yep. So the folks that we have put in housing are all folks who want to be in housing and also are interested in the supportive services. And that was, you know, 90-95% of the folks very much interested in all of the above. So these are folks that are wanting to do this. And we have professional caseworkers that are managed by the United Way of Broward County and other organizations that do this day in and day out and have been doing this for years and years. And those are the professionals that are working with these folks.
You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, I mean, the city has struggled at times in trying to tackle the issue of homelessness and how to help this part of your population. And it failed miserably. I mean, it made national news. What have you learned from those experiences? What has the city learned from those experiences? And where else are you looking, you know, to see who's doing it right? Are there cities that you could look to and say, we have to take that idea?
Yep. So, you know, when I was just a non-elected official, a citizen, just watching what the city of Fort Lauderdale's approach to homelessness with the kind of clearing out the camp and this enforcement and some of the kind of detention that happened and taking in possessions, you know, in my mind, that was not ideal. And there's a better way to do it. I think to address and really help those who are homeless, you really got to dig into the deeper systemic issues that they're facing. And it starts with housing as the first solution set. So this commission, and we've only been in office now about 9 months, has really taken a completely different approach. And that's one of the reasons why I think this is working. And then secondly, the mayor of Fort Lauderdale, Mayor Dean Trantelis, has been a big champion of this effort. And he and other leaders, the United Way and others, have gone to other cities to say, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing well? And so one of the cities that I went to with many others was we went down to Miami-Dade, just our neighbor to the south. And Ron Book helps lead an incredible program down there addressing the homeless. And one, they have some recurring revenue through a food and beverage tax, but they're doing amazing things. And so we took a lot of the best practices that they have and are using it here. Many other of our leaders went out to Orlando and other cities to see best practices.
We're talking with Fort Lauderdale Vice Mayor Ben Sorensen. We're talking about the homeless encampment in downtown Fort Lauderdale. It's now closed, and what the city is doing to help dozens of people who used to live there find housing and get the help that they need. I wanted to talk to you about the proposed housing development by the AIDS Foundation, and this has sparked some controversy. The 15-story tower would house hundreds of affordable housing units, 600 of which would only be 250 square feet. Now, the expected cost would be less than half of Broward County's median income. Is this housing development an intentional part of the county's plan to address the homeless issue?
No, it's not. It's not part of our holistic plan. And, you know, we do need more affordable housing in Fort Lauderdale. We need more affordable housing in Broward County. We need more workforce housing. And when you look at Broward County, there's a significant discrepancy between when you look at the difference between the cost of living and you look at the AMI, average median income. When you look at that percentage delta, it's greater than any other location in the United States because so many of our wages here are service side wages, so it's not as high in other communities. So we have to address this. You know, AIDS Healthcare Foundation has put forward this idea, and that's been, you know, very, very much a big topic of discussion.
What did you hear from you? There were quite a few people who showed up last night at the meeting, and they weren't happy about this. What did you hear from them? What are their concerns?
Yeah, so there's very valid concerns, and the concerns range from has AIDS Healthcare Foundation done projects like this in other parts of the country, and to what success? And you know, the answer we heard last night was no, that they haven't. That this would be, you know, the first time trying this. There's also concern around the size of the units. I mean, these are very small units. There's concern around what are the services that are going to be offered there or around in the vicinity. And so those are some of the real concerns.
And this, I mean, comes back to this bigger picture, this bigger question again, and not just, you know, whether it's this project or, you know, again, coming back to the issue of homelessness, dealing with the vulnerable part of our community is how do you find the right places to help get them the help they need, to help them find homes and housing, but then also to deal with, because this is also one of the issues you saw with the encampment, is that, well, there are a lot of people who don't want them around.
Yep. Yeah. So what we've been doing as a city, part of our plan has been identifying city property that can be used for affordable housing, workforce housing. And so the AIDS Healthcare Foundation is private land. It's not, doesn't fall under our umbrella from city owned land. So we've looked at, and I've been really a big proponent of, is let's identify unused land that we can then partner with private affordable housing developer and build, you know, small number of units in these places and have that spread throughout the city. And so that's something we're doing right now. We're looking at kind of in the southern part of the city, looking at a 100-unit affordable housing development there. And so that's part of what I see as the long-term fix.
And the city and county have got to agree on this.
And that's been one of the real exciting parts of this, Lewis, is that the engagement between the city and the county, I think, is better than it ever has been. And we've got both partners at the table. And I think initially we kind of did a little bit of the blame game and whose fault is it. And then in one of the meetings, I said, you know, fair to blame each other. And regardless of that, we're now where we are now. So can we work together? Are we willing to work together on this? And what I got back was a unanimous yes.
What do you think is the role of government in trying to help the most vulnerable in our community?
I think government plays a important role in this, and government cannot do this by itself. The reason this successful in Fort Lauderdale and has been is because government partnered with private businesses and with nonprofit sector and with the faith community, and said, let's work together. I think the government it plays an important role in identifying the concern and then starting to lead the effort, but quickly needs to bring on board the key stakeholders.
What more does Fort Lauderdale have to do? I mean, you've closed down the encampment, but you're getting these folks into housing, trying to get them the help they need, but there's still more homeless that we have to try to help. What more does the city need to do? What's the next step?
Yep. This is a long-term solution that we're going to need. We're not going to be able to solve this in the couple months. We've had fantastic successes already. We're going to continue to need this strong partnership across this triad. We're going to continue to need to identify revenue sources, whether that's grant funding, whether that's federal funding, whether that's private businesses stepping forward. And we're going to continue to need partners that are going to be willing to help provide the caseworkers, the job training, and the employment opportunities.
Do you think that homelessness can be solved?
Yes.
All right, I'm going to leave it at that then. That's all.
I think, Lewis, if you take the model that we're applying, it can be solved. And it needs to be solved because the financial drain on our resources as a city, as a state, as a nation are significant around the homeless. And if we can get them the help and the job training and support they need, not only does the resource drag lessen and tend to end, but then we start having really positive contributing members of society.
He's Fort Lauderdale Vice Mayor Ben Sorensen, again talking about the homeless encampment that was downtown in the center of downtown Fort Lauderdale, now closed. The city again has found the funds to help these folks find housing and also the help they need with mental health issues, substance abuse issues, trying to find jobs and so forth. A story definitely we're going to keep our eye on and we'll follow up. Vice Mayor Sorensen, such a pleasure. Thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, still to come. By the way, don't forget, I do have to mention this. Coming up at the end of the show, we're going to make an announcement about this month's Sundial Book Club, so stick around for that. But still to come on the program, celebrating Hanukkah in a time of rising anti-Semitism. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, it's been a little more than a month since the attack on the Tree of Life Congregation, a synagogue in Squirrel Hill that left 11 people dead. Jewish communities across the country are paying tribute to the lives lost this week in their Hanukkah gatherings that began on Sunday, including here in South Florida. The Levis Jewish Community Center in Boca Raton is no stranger to anti-Semitic incidents and is working with the multi-faith community to combat this problem. We're joined now by the president of the Levis Center, JCC, Randy Coleman. Randy, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And also joining us is Rabbi David Baum of the Shirei Kodesh, I hope I'm saying that right, Shirei Kodesh, excuse me, congregation. Rabbi Baum, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And they'll also update us, by the way, on the cultural events that are happening at the JCC this holiday season. So, but let's start with the tough stuff. Rabbi Baum, let me start with you. October 27th, take us back. What were the conversations like after that? Because that shook everybody across the country. I mean, any shooting does. Sadly, we've kind of gotten used to shootings, but this was unlike anything we'd seen.
So it's great to be here. Thank you for having us. I want to start by saying what happened that morning at our congregation was we actually had an anti-Semitic incident at our congregation that morning. Unconnected, unrelated. A man followed a family in the parking lot that was walking in, yelled Heil Hitler, did the Nazi salute, and made some anti-Semitic slurs. About a half hour later, we found out about what happened at Squirrel Hill at Tree of Life Synagogue. So I announced it to the congregation. And we've had armed security at our congregation for a number of years now, but this definitely woke people up even more to the vulnerability that we have. So we've received a lot of questions about security in our congregation and hardening our congregation and increasing security.
Well, first, let me start with this. How often that incident you talked about that happened that morning, how often does that happen?
It was the first time it's ever happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you talk about security, I mean, you've always had that security there, but I know that any shooting in a place of faith raises this question over and over again, is how much security should you have and should people be allowed to bring weapons to protect themselves? Was that a conversation?
We have had congregants ask about that. It's something that we're, discussing as a congregation. We haven't come to any conclusions yet. We have received advice from Homeland Security and police about the best thing to do.
And what do you think? Well, let me come back to this. I mean, I'd imagine there've got to be people who probably are thinking, I don't feel safe even going to a place of faith. So maybe not go. Have you heard that?
So the very next Saturday, the AJC, which is a Jewish organization, created a program called Show Up for Shabbat. And I honestly didn't know how many people would come. The attendance at our Shabbat services was as if it was the high holidays, meaning every seat was taken. We ran out of books. So that was a pretty incredible show of support from our congregants and even just people from the outside who came in just to show us support. So it has not affected our attendance.
And you've gotten a lot of support from the interfaith community as well.
So we had a vigil at B'nai Torah congregation, an interfaith vigil, which had 2,400 people in attendance. Just days later after the attack, I also received letters and phone calls from churches and mosques in the area, giving their support and just saying, we stand with you.
Randy, let me also ask you about this. I mean, overall, I'm wondering your thoughts on conversations that you have with folks about safety and what are you hearing? And, how do you keep people calm?
So as a Jewish community center with over 300 parents of preschool age students, security is obviously one of our most important priorities. This all changed for us after September 11th, 2001. We live on a campus with the Jewish Federation of South Palm Beach County. We're also the home to two other day schools, K-12, as well as our preschool. We have over 1,700 students on our campus on a daily basis. Security is a significant presence. It's a significant priority. We're constantly answering questions to parents who choose to come to us because they feel safe on our campus with our security presence. We've invested heavily with the support of our federation in security, and I like to think that we're one of the safest places for parents to come with their children. Not that we can prevent something from happening, but we're prepared to respond in seconds.
I mentioned at the beginning, and it's one of those things it's hard to put a number on, but talking to folks, different experts on this issue, is that we have seen a rise in anti-Semitic behavior over the last few years. Has that been your experience for both of you? I mean,
so last year, if you recall, there was a movement of bomb threats that were coming in through emails to JCCs and other Jewish organizations, and it was specifically a anti-Semitic event where they were targeting the Jewish community
up and down the East Coast.
Absolutely, yeah. We did receive one of those, working with Homeland Security and other Jewish organizations, as well as JCC Association, which is the National Association for the Jewish Community Centers. They heavily invested into providing us and equipping us with tools and systems to help us be prepared, to let us know that we might expect this and how to respond.
Rabbi Baum, coming back to the shooting in Pittsburgh, the shooter had argued that his motivation was because of the Jewish, you already know this, the Jewish involvement in this so-called caravan of migrants traveling through Central America to the United States. Nothing linking the migrant caravan to the Jewish community in the U.S. But I'm wondering if you can speak to the connection between the Jewish faith and the notion of accepting migrants into the community and the openness that you have to everybody.
Mm-hmm. So I believe the shooter was talking about HIAS, which is the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which is one of the oldest refugee organizations in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken, actually helped my family come to this country from Europe as refugees post-war. And we believe in this idea as Jews of protecting the stranger, the orphan. It's in the Bible. It's in the Hebrew Bible. You could see it more than maybe any other commandment. So it's an ethical imperative for us to look after the downtrodden and especially those who need a place to be safe.
Do you still have, I mean, you know, it's such a part of your faith, but at mm-hmm. the same time, with everything that we've seen, do you ever feel people are saying, are backing up and saying, we can't? Where's the mm-hmm. safety issue?
As far as welcoming people in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I believe that now is the time. You know, I was thinking about this, about what does the holiday mean, Hanukkah mean this year? You know, every year it means, it does, it means something else, I believe. The Talmud, who is our Jewish writings, rabbinic tradition, says, they ask a question, what is Hanukkah? They ask that question. And I think that every year we have to ask that question for us. In the Talmud, it talks about, there are these two rabbis, Hillel and Shammai, that talk about how we light the candles. One of the rabbis, Shammai, said, we light all 8 candles on the first night, 7 the second night, 6 the third night. Hillel, the other rabbi, said, no, we, on the first night, we have 1, the second night, 2, the third night, 3. So we know who won that debate, who was Hillel. And, but the reason he gave Hillel, he said, because we raise up in holy matters, we don't diminish from them. And I think that is the charge for us. That is the charge that we lean in more into holy acts. We don't retreat. And I think that we've seen that in the Jewish community. I think that this Hanukkah is about Jewish pride, unity, not just of Jews, but of our allies in this great country.
I'm talking with Rabbi David Baum of the Sharei Kodesh congregation. Also, I'm talking with Randy Coleman. He's the president of the Levis Center JCC. And it is Hanukkah. And so we wanted to talk about, you know, how the Jewish community here in South Florida is celebrating Hanukkah. And we did have to cover some of the tougher stuff, but let me lighten things up a little bit. You know, coming back to how you describe what the Jewish faith is and how to celebrate Hanukkah. And I think it's fascinating, Rabbi, as you said, how you're approaching it this year, this season. I just to follow up on that a little bit is kind of the conversations now that you're having with people going into the season. You know, how are people feeling? How are mm-hmm. people feeling now at this point? We're a little more than a month removed from what happened, but how are people feeling in general?
There is a traditional mourning period in Judaism of 30 days. It's called Shloshim, which means 30. And I think that people are now getting up from that mourning period of Tree of Life Synagogue and re-entering the world. So how are they feeling? I think this is a happy time. We light the candles to make ourselves, to bring joy and happiness. We also remember with those candles, it represents people as well. And so there is going to be, I believe, a shadow that's going to be cast on it, thinking about what happened at Tree of Life. But I do think that it's a time of happiness and joy. And I hope that as Jews, we can really engage in it.
Is this, by the way, is this considered an essential holiday in the Jewish tradition where folks who don't regularly attend synagogue would attend?
It's more of a home holiday and also a holiday out in the public. So, for example, tonight there's a big Hanukkah celebration in Boca Raton at the town center. So it's really a public holiday, more of a also at home, people light the Chanukiot, which is called the menorah, the candelabra, in their homes and their windowsills. So it's a great time for families to get together and eat oily foods and sing.
I want to hear from either of you on this. Help me understand this notion of folks in the community that see themselves as culturally Jewish. What does that mean? I've been hearing that. How is it unique to the Jewish faith compared to any other faith?
So I like to use that term because we know from a most recent demographic study we did in our community that only 20% of our community belong to a typical synagogue. We also know that 17% of our community have some affiliation with the Jewish Community Center. So it's a place where people can come together. While community is our middle name, Jewish is our first name. And so really most of our content and our programs has some Jewish content, but it's not necessarily a religious experience. It's more of a cultural experience. For instance, some of our programming during the month really deals with really cultural themes and Jewish themes, whether it's Hanukkah, which is the miracle of how the oil lasted for 8 nights. But we've got some great programs that bring people together. As Rabbi Baum alluded to, this is a time for the Jewish community to come together, to be proud, to be strong. Not only the Jewish community, the support we're getting from the secular community as well. It's been overflowing, and we're just proud of what we do every day to make an impact in people's lives.
And you talk about programs that you've got coming up. The Levis Center, JCC, has a number of them as part of this holiday. Tell us about the world premiere of a local playwright's work. What's going on?
So Dan Clancy, who's a local Carbonell Award-winning playwright, also wrote The Timekeepers in Middletown. We're running his show At Home, which runs through December 16th at our Levis JCC Sandler Center. The show is directed by Andy Rogow and also features talented actors Michael McKeever and Patty Gardner. It's a moving and inspiring portrait of a family over 50 years and the challenges they face, the successes, the mundane little things and big decisions that impact family life at a time of Hanukkah where the family is such an important role. We also are celebrating the centennial of Leonard Bernstein's birth, and his daughter Jamie Bernstein we're hosting on December 19th at Congregation B'nai Torah. She just recently wrote a book called The Famous Father Girl. She'll be with us to talk about her book and her life as the daughter of famous parents. She'll also be doing a book signing that night. And we also have on Christmas Day, we actually have a very Jewish concert of Christmas Day. It's the third year we're coordinating this with Aaron Kula, who's an accordionist and music director of his 9-member Klezmer Company Jazz Orchestra. They present some Yiddish songs, played American jazz style. It's really unique. The audience will hear some Cuban hora, a Klezmer mambo, Yiddish songs. And then typically what Jews do on Christmas Day is they go out for Chinese food afterwards.
Hold on a second. I love this part. Explain that part to me. Explain the part with the Chinese food, please.
So as you know, most local restaurants are closed on Christmas Day so everybody can observe and be with their family. The one restaurant that seems to be open wherever you go in the United States are Chinese restaurants. And if you go on Christmas Day, you'll see Jews flock to Chinese restaurants. I also want to add that the concert with Aaron Kula also has Karen Neal, who shares folk tales, and she might be familiar to some of your listeners as she's on the Public Storyteller program on a regular basis.
Right. I do also want to mention, I remember in high school, I worked at a Chinese restaurant, so I remember that. Let me finish with this, Rabbi Baum. What is the message that you have, not just for the Jewish community, but for the community as a whole here in South Florida as we going through this holiday season?
So I think that there's a special candle, actually, in the Chanukiah. It's called the Shamash. And it's the candle that lights all the other candles. It's not used for holy purposes, but it's used to bring holiness to the other candles. And it got me thinking, actually, about something that Fred Rogers said, the famous Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Rogers.
And for those who don't know, he was in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood. That's where he grew up and lived. And it got me thinking about one of his famous quotes. He said, "When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping.'" And I think that when it comes to the Shamash is that helper candle. And I think that not just Jews, but everyone, this is a time when we can help people, where we could be kind to people, where we can shine the light of justice and of peace to everyone in our country. And I hope that as a community, as a South Florida community, that we can, all of us can engage in that.
Beautiful message, and ending with a Mr. Rogers message. That's the best way to go. Again, he is Rabbi David Baum of the Sherei Kodesh congregation. We also heard from Randy Coleman, president of the Levis Center JCC. Happy Hanukkah. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here today. Appreciate it.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
All right. By the way, you're listening to Leonard Bernstein's America from West Side Story. So a little bit of that for you. Still to come, we're going to meet two local artists and their take on Art Basel and Miami Art Week. That's coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami's art scene is growing, and it's evident in the thousands of artists and buyers and art lovers from around the world who come to Miami for Art Basel. Now, not everyone will be going to the Miami Beach Convention Center for the big fair. There are numerous other events for Miami Art Week, and some are free. There are also pop-up installations in places like Wynwood, Overtown, and Little Haiti, like this one. Well, that's the sound of one of the installations called Everglades that will be part of Miami Art Week. It's an immersive experience that includes acoustic sounds and actual materials from the National Park, from the Everglades National Park. We're joined now by Kathy Bird, founder and artistic director of the podcast Fresh Art International. Kathy, great to have you back.
Thank you, Louis.
Should I say Happy Miami Art Week? Is that the
It could be.
Happy
could
Art
be
Basel?
Happy.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure. Also joining us is Octavia Yearwood, a local artist, author, and performer teaching the arts to at-risk teenage girls in Miami, and she's going to share some of her work with us. Octavia, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure, pleasure.
Also joining us is, and you heard the sounds coming from the artist, Gustavo Matamoros. Gustavo, that was some fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to talk about that as well. I appreciate it. And by the way, I just wanted to say that we posted up on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you if you've been to Art Basel or Miami Art Week in the past. What's the best way to experience it? Share your thoughts with us. We'd love to hear from you. Kathy, I'm going to start with you real quickly. What is the best way to experience all of this? It's a lot.
It's a lot. It is a lot. Well, you could use my curated art guide.
Okay.
That I posted on freshartinternational.com. And I say that wherever you live in Miami, there are going to be things happening that you can reach without getting in the traffic that you talked about with Brett Sokol yesterday.
Oh, let's not even get into that. I know. All right. We're going to talk about some of these here. Gustavo, let me start with you, though. I want to get into your exhibit. We just heard those sounds real quickly. Tell us about Everglades, because it sounds really fascinating.
Okay. The installation that I have up at the Art Center South Florida in my studio at it's a Studio 201, second floor. It's a Knight Foundation project that involves 30 channels of audio, and displays a piece that includes four parts. One of those is the Everglades piece. Those sounds were recorded during an IRI residency I had in 2013 at the Everglades National Park.
So when I go there, how am I going to experience it?
Well, I experienced these sounds mostly at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of the Everglades. You go to one of the stations and, you know, turn on your tape recorder and microphone, and you hear the most fascinating sounds.
Those are some very fascinating sounds. And, but, you know, the other thing, too, just I wanted to know, what is it you want us to experience most? Is it just that what you experienced at 2 in the morning?
Well, actually, the project is actually best experience on site. You know, it's about the three-dimensionality of sound. And so the content itself is sort of a part of the experience. So it's almost like going to the theater and listening to surround sound or 3D sounds, exactly. Yeah. So it's about the experience of the sounds. It's also about introducing people to the sounds of the area, which are not often available to everyone.
No, we live right next to it, but not everybody's been out there to experience it.
Exactly, so.
You know what, we talked about this on the show yesterday, and it's just kind of the theme, is this idea that Art Basel is sometimes seen as that, you know, it's really only for certain people and the people who have the money to afford some of that art. But Octavia, I wanted to know from you, what is the importance, first of all, of just making sure that we make art more accessible to everybody?
I mean, for one, art is extremely valuable, not only in just it having as a possession, but the experience of it. Right, experiencing the perspective from different artists and different mediums and what it can do for you, what it can show you as far as your efficacy, what's possible, especially for various communities that occupy Miami that people never really think about or consider sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, so the accessibility is a really important thing for us. You know, Espinello Projects with Creating Free and for many, 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 many different artists throughout Miami that make it accessible.
For you, what is Miami Art Week? What is this week going to be about?
Ooh, this is NPR, so I don't want to be
that's all right.
too crazy, but I felt like that was such a nice and provocative question.
Every now and then I get a good one.
It gave me all the feels. For me, what it always is about creativity. It's about a platform to let light shine on various artists who really, really, really play into the ecosystem of Miami's art scene. For me, I get excited with seeing the artists that are here actually get shine and are able to sell their work and are able to engage.
You've got one of these pop-ups.
That's I do.
What? Tell us about it.
Libations. Libations is a performance art piece that I created thinking about my grandmother, thinking about my childhood and thinking about how they got together and how they connected, how they told stories and sometimes seemed like the same story over and over and over again, and how they drank and how they just used that to really bond and connect. What I realized in my healing process was that telling my story really helped me not only connect to myself and my childlike self, but also connect to others. So libation is that way for me to bring people together based around a certain topic over a table that has elements of the past, present, and the future done as an installation, and have us talk and drink together while the audience kind of sit in like voyeurs, like the kids did when we were sitting in that corner and watching our parents talk and hearing these stories all over again, and allowing a space though for them to hear other people's story and find a point of connection, a point of entry. A lot of times when libations is done, people come over to the other artists at the table and they're like, I remember that. I experienced that too. I had a grandmother like that. Oh, that was what my coming out story looked like too. Or, oh, this is how I feel about what being free means, you know? So this libation is about free. It's in relation to our exhibition at the Brickell City Center that's opening on the 6th. And libation is on the 7th. And we just have a plethora of engagements that are happening within this structure that is very much the bones, with the artist truly being the meat.
And by the way, you're going to be taking some of your students too, right? For the experience, or what is it you're doing with them? What are you going to be doing?
I'm letting them know it's happening.
Okay. You know?
if their parents want to swing through, they can, and they can for free.
All right. Well, there you go. Again, talking about Miami Art Week and Art Basel, beyond the experience that people may have if you go to the big fair, obviously in Miami Beach, there's a lot that's going on all week. And so, and not all of it is going to be expensive, and some of it is free. And there's a lot of local artists, because I know that one of the things about Art Basel is you've got a lot of artists from around the world mm-hmm. that come here to get the attention. And that's okay. It's not a bad thing, but there are a lot of really good local artists here, and we need to bring attention to them. We've been hearing from Octavia Yearwood. She's one of those local artists. We've also heard from Gustavo Matamoros, one of the local artists. He's got a fascinating piece. He's working with sound And of course, we're talking with Kathy Bird, founder and artistic director of the podcast Fresh Art International. Kathy, you recently released an episode on your podcast touching on a couple of the events happening around the city that are more accessible. What are a couple of those that people should know about? And again, I'm thinking about people who, they've never been to this.
Right.
And it's intimidating. Mm-hmm. It could be very intimidating.
Right. Well, on Miami Beach, there is the Audiotech experience with Gustavo. There's another sound artist that was just commissioned to do a project for Soundscape Park. And that will be audible every day from noon to midnight, I think. Different versions of it will be accessible. People walking through the park can have a sound art experience. One of mockingbirds, like as a friendly surround of mockingbirds. And then at night, the sound of our seascape around South Florida, which is really beautiful with a video element. There's also on the beachfront at Collins Park, there's going to be a solar energy plus art exhibition with Tomas Saraceno, with everyday solar cooking, an aeroscene project where they'll be flying something like a kite with solar energy on the beach every day, which is very cool. We've got the free art fair at Brickell, which is so counterintuitive for some people to think of a shopping mecca to be a site. PAM, Paris Art Museum, has free art night on Thursday night. You can see all their exhibitions and performance for free.
I want to do this because before I run out of time, and I want to go around the table and ask people this question, because look, Art Basel, and we talked about this yesterday with Brett Sokol, is how Miami attracted this big event because we proved this could be a great place for artists. But, and Octavia, let me start with you. Is this a great place for local artists? Miami's great for a lot of people to visit, but is it a great place to be a local artist? Can you thrive?
Yes, and I'm going to tell you why, because I mean, there's probably local artists listening right now like, hell no, man, we got to get out of here. But here's what I think as being an artist, right? Miami provides you the ability to grow, to really play around with your ideas, to really investigate and also collaborate with other artists on how to expand on your work. And I think that right there is an enormous value when you're talking about being an artist, because being innovative and continuously expanding what it looks like to create and what your medium looks like and how you can expand on that is really important. Like, for instance, Frankie Cruz, who is one of the local artists that is in Free, which Free, again, is you're going to have performance. You're going to have on view, meaning vinyls of people's work all over the mall, and sculptures like Misael Soto's signs. But Frankie Cruz in particular is a local artist who he is growing butterflies and making video art out of their crystallization, right? When they turn and they blossom out, right? He's making video art out of that. And then there's this excretion that the butterflies let out when they hatch, and the excretion, he's taking that to make art pieces with too. Where else in the world are you seeing people doing that? Look, come on now.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because we had him on the show and he talked about that process.
It's amazing. And that is the type of landscape that Miami provides for a local artist to be even better.
All right, real quickly, Gustavo, just for you, real quickly, your take in less than 60 seconds. Is this a good place for artists? You've been here a long time.
Yes, although my work has been shown around and internationally, I've been a local artist for 35 years, and I think the strength of Miami has been a very good place to experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gustavo Matamoros, again, he's got a featured piece that you got to check out. It's a sound piece. It's called Everglades. Octavia Yearwood, a local artist, author and performer, and working and teaching with young at-risk teenage girls in Miami.
And boys.
And boys. Thank you for bringing that. And Kathy Bird, founder and artistic director of the podcast Fresh Art International. I have to end it there because I'm out of time. But thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it. It is that time, by the way, the first Tuesday of the month when we announced our new Sundial Book Club title. And we decided for this month, we want you to tell us actually about your favorite holiday book and why. And we spoke with a couple of the folks here at WLRN, including Sundial producer Alejandro Martinez, All Things Considered producer Alex Gonzalez, and digital director Teresa Frontado. Here's Teresa.
favorite holiday reading has to be the Polar Express. When my son was little, he was crazy about trains, so I bought him that book and we read it together, and we did it for many Christmas. My son is now 17, but I still have the book, and I still have so many memories for me of Christmas past.
My name is Alexander Gonzalez, and one of my favorite holiday books is the second book in the Chronicles of Narnia series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. As a native Floridian, it was magical to escape through the wardrobe into a winter wonderland, and the best part was I didn't have to wear a coat to experience it.
Hello, everyone. My name is Alejandra Martinez, and one of my favorite holiday books is Too Many Tamales. It's the perfect representation of how my Christmas day would go. So the family's gathered around making tamales for the holidays, just like any other Mexican household. But in this book, the mom takes off her wedding ring and the daughter picks it up and chooses to wear it while making tamales. The daughter does not realize her huge mistake until after the tamales are made and she notices the ring is not on her hand anymore. Let's just say I would not like to be the daughter because I would not like to experience La Chancleta during Christmas time.
All right, so we want to hear from you. What is your favorite holiday book? It could be anything that you love to read during the holidays. Send us a picture of you in that book. Email it to sundial@wlrnnews.org. Or you could send us an audio clip too. Just use your phone to tape yourself 30 seconds. Tell us about your favorite book. Now, we're going to talk with Mitchell Kaplan of Books and Books next week for a Sundial Book Club special. Also, we want to challenge our followers. If you're following us on our Facebook group, Sundial Book Club, if you're not a member, by the way, just ask to join. We want everybody involved. If a friend were moving to South Florida and they asked you for one book that best depicts life here in this quirky little part of our country, what would that book be? Again, only book club members can give us an answer to that. So join, please. Well, that's our program for today. This Tuesday, December 4th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the Biscayne Park police chief has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for framing black men in a community for crimes they did not commit. We're going to get an update on that story. Plus, we're going to give you an update on the Superfine Art Fair happening as part of Miami Art Week. That's tomorrow on the show. Remember, find us online, WLRN.org, or on Facebook, Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Here and Now is next here on 91.3 WLRN and HD1 Miami Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM and HD1 Marathon Key West, 90.7 WFLV HD2 West Palm Beach, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches. Gregorian chant and traditional English carols anchor South Florida's Grammy-nominated holiday tradition, a seraphic fire Christmas, this month, December 6th through 16th in Boca Raton, Coral Gables, Miami Beach, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Naples, and Cutler Bay. Tickets on sale at seraphicfire.org or 305-285-9060.